This version of the podcast is mixed in mono, but if you would like to listen in 5.1 surround sound, please visit ufocast.co.uk/prisoner for more details. This is episode 1, and it is the first that we recorded back in November 2021. Welcome to episode 1 of By Hook or By Crook, a podcast about The Prisoner, starring me, Luke, and my co-host...
Me, Michael, from the Tin Dog Podcast. You've probably heard lots and lots and lots of podcasts from us in the past. And here's another one. Yay.
Yay, finally. And we have been talking about doing this for literally years and years. And part of the reason it's taken this long is because our guest today did their own Prisoner podcast about the last time we decided we were going to do it. And we were like, oh, we're not going to do it at the same time. So we then did the UFO cast instead, which took several years. So we're now back to doing it, and we thought we would have them on. So Stephen and Erica have decided to join us for discussing Arrival. Hello to both of you.
Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us. I bet you didn't know that.
I did.
You were responsible for postponing us.
Listen. We did ours for the 50th anniversary.
Yes.
Of The Prisoner. Obviously, you probably had the same idea that you would do that. So I'm sorry that we scuppered your dreams. I do know that NPR, Glenn Weldon of the Pop Culture Happy Hour, also recently put out a Prisoner podcast, but that finished. I think that's done now. So you, once again, in your postponement of your original idea, it's been long enough that another Prisoner podcast has come and gone for you to, you know, not have to share the limelight again.
It's all you guys.
I went up to look at one of the Derby Doctor Who conventions and I went... I am tempted to do a Prisoner podcast. And he went, oh, yeah, let's talk about that. So a year later, we went, we didn't actually discuss that, did we? And it went on like that for a long time. Mind you, though, we would never have done the UFO cast. And that was brilliant. You know, so it was only, what, 26 episodes? And it did take a long time to do because we were doing like one a month when we could organize it. And I mean... He didn't have any children when we started that. He's got two now. It's really been that long.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think part of the procrastination about the Prisoner podcast was because Zoe had just about been born, and I was sleep deprived, so I probably hadn't noticed it was the 50th anniversary of The Prisoner until you guys went, "Oh, we're doing this podcast." Stephen and Erica, where can people find your podcast if after listening to this they want to hear more of you? Are talking about The Prisoner, about all the rest of the episodes in the series.
I had to gently remind Erica that we did a Prisoner podcast before we pressed record. It was so long ago.
No. I remember. It's on the Incomparable Network. It is called In the Village. So I think it's theincomparable.com/prisoner. I believe that's all of the episodes are right there.
Well, we will check that link out and we'll put it in the show notes. If it's something different, you will see. So the format of the show is that we, as we record this, we've lined up guests for probably just over half the episodes. By the time these all go out, we will hopefully have a guest for every single one. And we want to find out from those guests why they're Prisoner fans in the first place and why they've chosen this particular episode to discuss before we then get into reviewing it. Stephen is kindly going to come back later in the series for another episode. So we're going to focus on Erica today. So, Erica, how did you become a Prisoner fan? First and foremost, what is it about the series that you enjoy and want to talk about on the podcast?
Well, I can't nail down exactly when I first heard of it. I'm sure I heard the phrase "The Prisoner" in concert with the, you know, meaning the show, multiple times, just because I was surrounded by geeks, because I'm also one. But I was able to look up and pinpoint the moment where the show truly entered my consciousness, and I didn't start watching it then, but. On September 11th, 2002, The Onion, and I don't know if you're familiar with The Onion, but it is a these days well-known satire website. But at the time, in 2002, it was just a little newspaper that came out in Madison, Wisconsin, and I think it had gone as far as Milwaukee at the time. But I don't remember when it actually hit the internet, but it was just a paper thing that came out, and I went to college in Madison, Wisconsin, so... I would always read The Onion. And there were articles written by a fictional journalist named Larry Groznick. And the picture that was used of Larry Groznick was actually my late friend Joel. So it was always delightful to see Joel's face staring at me from the pages of The Onion. And this was like the geeky reporter, the reporter in the geek beat. And the articles were always fun. This particular article that came out on that day, the headline was, "I regret to say your wedding falls square in the middle of the prisoner marathon." And it is a delightful article. I was able to find it. It's actually on the Onion website still, about how basically it's a regrets letter saying, "I can't make it to your wedding because it's on the weekend of the prisoner marathon. And you, sir, are also a fan of the prisoner. How dare you schedule your wedding on this weekend?" And it, I mean, it goes into some very specific, like whoever wrote this article was definitely a fan of the prisoner. And I read it and I didn't know anything about the show, but I found it delightful anyway, because, you know, as a nerd, I was just like, yeah, who schedules their wedding on the weekend of a marathon of something that they love? That's just not right. And and I was like, okay, this is the thing that I need to track down and I need to watch. Cut to how many years later, Stephen?
when did we first watch it together? Because when we watched it for the podcast, you had already seen it once time through.
Yeah, you showed it to me after I moved here.
Yes.
And I moved here to Canada from the States in 2014.
Yeah.
So it was sometime after 2014. So it took me a good number of years to actually get around to watching The Prisoner. But the first... I still remember sitting down to watch the first episode, and I don't know what prompted it. We just decided we were going to watch it. And I have never fallen so hard, so fast for any TV show ever after a pilot. It just absolutely swept me up and took me along for the ride. And I wanted to know what the heck was happening. I wanted to know why. I was just as baffled as the main character. And yeah, Arrival to this day still remains my favorite Prisoner episode because of that. I mean, I love Beginnings just in general, but I think I don't think I have ever had quite that visceral of an experience watching the first episode of a television show, and just as even one that had been talked up as much as The Prisoner, I was like, there's no way it's going to live up to the hype. And holy moly, it really, really did. So when we watched it for the podcast, it was my second time through because we had already seen it all the way through once.
So what is it about Arrival in particular that grabbed you so much?
I am a sucker for a storyline where the audience is being brought along with the main character. The main character is trying to figure things out, doesn't know what's happening, and I feel like it, for me, creates an instant connection with the character to be as lost as they are in terms of knowing what on earth is happening. So from the very, very beginning, where you get to see, you know, he resigns, he's shouting and is basically X'd out of and filed away by the time he gets back home. And just the sheer audacity of having him wake up and be in his same home but also someplace else was just like, what a mind trip. It was so delightfully baffling. And then to have him wander around, I felt what the character was feeling so deeply that it resonated with me on like on the level of my bones, man, my bones.
Wow. So were you aware of Port Merion as a setting before you watched The Prisoner, or was this your first exposure to that well?
I think it must have been. I mean, I had heard the term Port Merion, but I didn't really know what it meant, and I certainly hadn't seen very many visuals at all. I think the only visual I had really seen of The Prisoner beforehand would have been like Rover and maybe a penny farthing. So I did not know about the setting beforehand, and discovering its like just quirky charm at the same time as having it feel so sinister is it's such a delightful juxtaposition. It was really a wonderful experience to watch that for the first time and see this place. And now it's like one of my life goals is I need to visit Port Merion at some point before I die. Please.
I really need to.
I was fortunate
enough to visit, I visited as a kid, and I don't remember that at all. I was far too small. And then I was lucky enough to visit again last summer during the sort of first easing of lockdown in the UK. We went camping, and I went to Port Merion. Have you been, Michael?
I have. I've been twice. The first time I went was very early on in my relationship with my wife, and she was like, "Oh, let's go to Wales," and I was like, "Oh, while we're going to North Wales, could we possibly pop here?" I've always fancied going, and it was like, "Yes, circled on the map, definitely." And one of my favourite photographs of her is just us sitting on the grass near the checkerboard, just reading. We'd been to a bookstore earlier that day, and it was just one of those gloriously summer days that all sort of sneak up on you. And it was just so good. Because I was like, I'm here, I'm in The Prisoner. And this was before the revivals, or it hadn't been on the TV for years, but it was sort of me just having a complete geek out and her going, yep, this is it. I'm stuck with him forever now. So that was it. She was, we were there. And then when we got married in North Wales, and my best mate, who was my best man, who's now, again, no longer with us, he'd always wanted to visit Port Merion. So I was like, yeah, Andy, we'll take you there. So we went in, and he got to be there. So there's actually a photograph of him on the wall in the dining room, of him sitting on the concrete boat with the buildings behind and everything. And it's just like, so every evening when we sit down for a meal, it's like Port Merion's in the living room. Mm-hmm. It's just... aww. Everyone's saying, it's a magical place, but it literally is. And after you've seen the TV program, you're like, oh my God, it's there. But it is kind of a village where you actually wouldn't mind being trapped, because it just feels so nice. There was a TV documentary series as well about a year ago on here. And it was about the people who keep the place running. It was on ITV. I think it was lasted 6 weeks. And it was all about the gardeners and things like that. But every week I would just sort of be completely transfixed going, oh, that was seen this scene and that was in this scene. I'm thinking, no, just enjoy the show. It's a one of those nice reality TV programs about a country park kind of thing. But really it's not. It's like, this is how we look after the village. It's like, which one's number two? And it's none of them. And it was just so nice. So, yeah.
I mean, it's interesting.
Oh, I have one question. Sorry. No, you ask. I'll ask my question later. It's very boring.
Okay. And I was just going to say, it's interesting, Erica, how you picked up the sinister nature of how it comes across on screen. Because one of the things that I realized in visiting it last year was that it's not in reality. Hmm. Like, when you're there, it's just this picturesque, crazy kind of folly. And it's very much not the village, or at least that was my experience of being there, possibly because it's had fresh kind of coats of paint, possibly because it is kind of working as this kind of hustling, bustling tourist attraction. So what is it about the way that it appears on screen in the Prisoner that makes it so sinister, do you think?
Well, I'm
going to throw that to Erica, but also anybody else who wants to chip in.
I think that if you were standing in the middle of it and every time you looked at a building, it was from a slightly low-angled shot, or with the shadows just so, or with the music being just the right amount of creepy. Like, you know, if you're climbing up the stairs toward the Green Dome and suddenly you hear Pop Goes the Weasel, but it's a creepy version that, like, cuts off at weird asynchronous times and then turns into a jazz version. Like, I feel like maybe you would probably have felt a little bit more uncomfortable in the real version of it. So I credit a lot of the direction, the sound mixing, the choices in the editing, because it really, I suppose I could picture it just being nice and delightful, but I feel like I would have to be there and experience that myself, because right now my only reference point for it is seeing it as it is brought to life on the screen through the eyes of a man who has no idea how he got there, doesn't know why he's there, and doesn't know who's in charge.
Yeah, also, there's no tiny butlers, and there's no giant rovers, and there's no mini mokes. What you're surrounded by is tourists. It's as if it's a tribute. Well, they are there if you go on a certain weekend, but I haven't been to those. So it is. I think the way the sinister bit comes from the way it's shot. The opening sequence for me feels like a spaghetti western. The way it's all sort of very tight angles on the face, and his the way he discovers it before he meets the woman in the cafe. It's portrayed very sinisterly, and that kind of stays with you as he discovers more from a cinematic point of view. I think the setups, like you said, it's so good. My only other story is that I will put my hand up. In the cafe, I stole a spoon that I still use every day as well.
Oh, yeah. My.
I know. Goodness. It's possibly the only thing I've ever stolen in my entire life.
I've stolen so many spoons from so many different places. It's a thing for me. So, I'm with you.
In that Doctor Who episode where Capaldi says, you know, I have a special spoon, I was like, so do I, mate. It's fine. It's... Right, okay, one question.
Okay, go on.
Let me get this out of the way. It's about the opening sequence, and it's the one thing that I remembered from your the original Prisoner podcast, the one that so rudely interrupted us. You said that you were a typewriter nerd and you knew that the letter X that was striking out the picture was not the correct one. Now, A, how can you spot that? Because I watched the opening credits this evening and I'm thinking, no, that's just a flying arm. You can't possibly be that correct.
No,
but
it's
maybe
the
you
letter
are.
H.
What have I missed?
I actually commented on that again as we watched
literally,
it.
Literally again.
Yeah, as the shot of the X's going over his face are going over his face, I was going X, 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 X. And then when it's showing the typewriter, I was saying H, 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 H.
Where is X, though, on the carriage, I wonder? Like, is it far to one side
that maybe it doesn't
look as visually appealing?
I am 100% certain that was simply a directorial choice. We want this to look as striking as possible. It's going to look better if it's coming up from the middle of the screen, like right at your face, basically. Yeah. If it's coming up from the side, it's not necessarily going to have the same pop. So they just chose that thinking, you know, it's the 1960s. Nobody's TV is clear enough that you can actually see that. But we have the Blu-ray and a very large television, which we sit probably too close to. And it's very just clear that is not an X. So I'm not even a huge typewriter nerd. I couldn't tell you exactly where it is. I have a friend who collects them. But
talking of picture quality on the Blu-ray, I for the first time noticed what George Markstein is doing. He's the guy that's sitting at the desk when Patrick McGoohan comes in to resign.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never looked at him before, and I realized he's just sat there sharpening a pencil.
I never looked at that.
I love the kind of business that happens in the background.
It's like just doing nothing, sharpening a pencil. The thing with the prisoner is that everything is so deliberate that the sharpening that pencil, like that means something. That's not just some random background action that George Markstein's doing.
I mean, you tell me, Stephen. This is one of the questions that I want to ask everybody who comes on the podcast, because this is a show that has been analysed to death, partly because of the fact that it was a team effort, but it was driven by Patrick McGoohan. So much of the DNA is from him, and he was so enigmatic about it, and very non-committal about it in interviews, and rarely was interviewed. And even the documentary that came out a few years ago, in my mind, I thoroughly recommend it, but it still leaves a lot open to, like, well, what the heck was he thinking?
Mm-hmm.
So what does The Prisoner mean to each of you? What do you think it's about? Without revealing the final spoiler, because I think there'll be people listening along as they watch this for the first time.
Right.
So without kind of going into too much detail about where this eventually ends up, what does The Prisoner mean? What does it stand for? What's the message? Or does that even matter?
I don't think it needs a message. I don't want a message. I want delightful, slightly baffling entertainment. I want entertainment that's just the right amount of baffling.
Mm-hmm. Which I think it is. I think David Lynch veers too far afield to the baffling territory. Mm-hmm. This feels surreal but intriguing.
For a while.
Erica and I disagree on how the series ended.
Deeply,
but
deeply.
More on that later.
Okay. Which is why I think I enjoy this episode the most, because it is, there's not a lot of, well, there's not a lot of question, because all there is are questions in this episode.
Which are, of course, a burden to others.
Yes, indeed. it's just set up and it's asking the questions. And I think I love this moment that we have right here. It is asking all of the questions and it doesn't require the burden of an answer, because it's just delightful. As The Prisoner goes on, we do get more information. Sometimes it seems conflicting, sometimes it's confusing. I like the I I like the fact that so many people view this show so differently, that so many people can take such completely vastly different things away from it. I tend to be a fairly boring, middle-of-the-road, left-brained thinker. I want point A to lead to point B to lead to point C. So I have a tendency to interpret things with the most sort of surfacey ideas about them. I like sometimes thinking about, like, oh, what could this possibly mean? But in the end, I'm going to default to this thing that they told me and they showed me is probably, you know, like Occam's razor. So, which is why I don't necessarily get into all of the super deep weirdness with my heart as much as a lot of people do, but I still enjoy that there are all of those things. And I mean, random little things, like even in this very episode, as Stephen was pointing out as we watched it, like the number 7 doesn't appear anywhere. Like that's the kind of specific choice that I really enjoy thinking about. But the fact that the show doesn't give us any specific answers means that I don't necessarily, I'm not going to land on any answers for myself. For the most part, I'm just going to take it in and enjoy it. And when it gets really, really weird, I'm just going to pretend it didn't happen. I think okay. That's what I land on.
I think it's...
No, I mean, that makes a lot of sense, just letting it wash over you like that.
I look at it as like very much just sort of a counterculture protest on the part of Patrick McGruen. I feel like he's protesting both about the world that is happening around him, be it world events and everything, but also just his own career and him sort of being pigeonholed as this secret agent, literally secret agent man, and, you know, being courted to be the first James Bond in the movies and stuff, and him just casting that whole lifestyle and that, you know, notion out the window and just beating it to death and then never returning to it. I feel like that's just... It's very, I know, you, as you say, Luke, it's a very much a team effort, but it feels like a very personal statement by McGoohan. Some even more, episodes even more, like the ones that he wrote or directed, sometimes under a pseudonym, that I just feel like that's his statement to the world, and then he gets out. It's his Sergeant Pepper's,
and
basically.
This kind of boils down to a fundamental difference in the way that Stephen and I process media. I don't know if on your previous podcasts you guys have talked about the differences between the Watsonian and Doyleist views of media.
Oh, yeah.
So I tend to be a very Watsonian viewer / reader, etc. I tend to be looking at the story of something from the world of the story. I'm viewing it from a lens of within the fiction. And then you've got Stephen over there on the Doyleist side, who is looking at, oh, Patrick McGoohan had this experience in his real life, so this is why he was creating it the way he was. But it's, which is fun. It makes for a really good discussion whenever we decide to talk about something.
I mean, that's interesting, because the whole Danger Man, or as you said, Secret Agent, as it was known over in the States, provides a background to the opening of this story. And Arrival wasn't the first episode that I saw. Michael and I will have talked about this in episode 0, which we haven't recorded yet, just to kind of confuse you. But Arrival wasn't the first episode
that
I saw.
Just like The Prisoner.
Just like The Prisoner. So I was familiar with the regular shortened version of the opening sequence, obviously it still does a lot of storytelling, but is like, wow, okay, there's a lot going on there. And I had assumed that we would get a lot more at the beginning of Arrival. And that opening sequence is slightly longer, in that you get like the shot of him pulling up at the parking meter and pulling out the ticket, and the shot of the hearse. And there's a few other things that makes it a bit longer, but it is still a very short piece of storytelling. And if you don't know that he's come off the back of a show where he's playing a secret agent, is it even obvious from the beginning of Arrival?
No.
That's who he is and that's what he's resigning from? I'm not even sure that's what just you pick up. I don't know.
The fact that he is, like, I never heard of Danger Man at all before I saw it back when I was a teenager. Just the fact that he's going to this, you know, mysterious place, walking down this dark corridor, resigning, there's like this big, massive robotic arm in this crazy room that's, you know, he's up by his identification, he seems like a spy or someone doing.
Yeah, I think the infamous typewriter sequence is that's what gives it away for me. The fact that like that card with his face on it, and you know he is clearly a government operative of some sort, and he is being X'd out of the picture. So I think that is sort of what told the tale for me, because I also had never heard of Danger Man or Secret Agent Man. I didn't know who Patrick McGoohan was. I didn't have any of the backstory, so I didn't
just
know.
Going
I think it
from,
gives you just
from
enough.
Any version, yeah. Just going off any of the versions of the opening sequence, though, when he's there's the garden, which is opposite the House of Commons, and he does a right turn and he goes underneath there, which is where the BBC have got they always film interviews with MPs and stuff on that grassy area that you actually see next to the car park. So that is quite definitely governmental building. So you know he works for the government if you're from the UK and you know the vaguely out of London. But that's kind of just where he drives into this mysterious underground car park. But that's all you know. And I must admit, I've been reading up on Alex Cox's book on The Prisoner as well before I did this. And he sort of works out from each episode what his job could be. working, which is fine, apart from one episode which completely scuppers everything, which I'm sure we'll cover as we go on. But he does definitely have worked for the government in some sort of intelligence, not necessarily a spy. He's not Danger Man, but he looks like him, he's dressed like him, and the publicity still from Danger Man is the one that gets X'd out. Yeah. So you can forgive the rest of the audience for forgiving for seeing it that way. And you can also forgive Lou Grade for going, yeah, I just want more episodes of Danger Man. Can we not just make some of those? Yeah, I'll give you some cash. Which is how he almost tricks him into paying for it.
And that works. I guess the thing for me, and you'll probably think I'm really daft for this, Michael, is that in my head I had somehow not linked the shot of the House of Commons with where he then drives. For me, it was just like, oh, we're establishing that we're in London now. And then it wasn't until much more recently that I was like, oh, he's actually supposed to be. Anyway, that's all by the by. So anyway, we've rambled on for quite a while without even really touching on the plot. And this is one of the things that I like about this episode that struck me this time round in particular. It's just how much is packed into that first 50 minutes.
It's the entire series is here. Everything.
Yes.
Everything that you see in every episode is here.
Yeah. Yeah. There's just so much world building going on. You've got the whole he's arrived and his house. Just a very quick point. His house is a TARDIS because having been to Port Merion, there is no way you can fit that house inside that building. But that's another tale. So obviously you have this whole kind of like what's happened to him, what's going on, meeting all these people, and then you have the reveal of number two. And this episode, it's we've got two of you, which kind of works because we've got two number twos. Uh-huh. So what do we think of the role of number two, and how the two of them play out in this episode?
I like that it establishes right off the mark that number two's change. You know, had they not done that, had it been the same number two throughout the whole episode, then next week it's Leo McKern, or depending where you are, Calden Gordon. I don't know what the order of these things are, but you know, it establishes that there are going to be lots of number twos, sometimes maybe more than one a week. That's what I like, because if I think it might have undermined the power of that by just having the same number two and then making it seem like number two is you know really important, but really he's just doing his 2 week stint. Let's face it, you know, trying to break him on to the next one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you get the first reveal of the first number two is such a delight. Stephen had been reading some article about like what ultra rich people are doing in London with basements or something, and I was like, if I was an ultra rich person, I wouldn't need an entire basement. I would just need enough space underneath the floor so that I could have my little globe chair rise up out of it, so that I could present myself just ridiculously to all comers, because that is a moment, like capital A, capital M, a moment, where you see that chair come up and turn around and, oh, there's a fellow sitting there, and he has a stripy scarf and an umbrella. And it's just, it's such a weird moment that still feels all of a piece with the rest of everything else that you're seeing in this episode. And it's clear that this is the person with control. He literally has controls in front of him, which he presses with the, you know, with the umbrella and, you know, chairs popping up out of the floor and breakfast. And just, it is delightfully odd. And and I think Stephen is bang on that it's important that we change number twos during this episode, because it seems that this is the person who is holding, again, who has the control, who has all the controls right in front of him. And we need to learn, I think, pretty quickly that that's not necessarily the case. It's basically, we have the rug pulled out from underneath us completely twice in this episode. The first time is when he wakes up and he is not where he expected to be. And the second time is when he enters that room and suddenly there's just another number two and he is totally blasé about it. And you're like, what is happening?
Yeah, he's not going up against one man or one person in the form of number two. He's going up against the village or the system.
The establishment.
That's what that change indicates. That it doesn't matter how many times it changes, you're still going against the same enemy.
But you still don't know who that enemy is exactly. Nope. It makes this faceless enemy even more faceless because you don't have like the one face that you can put to it. It's a different face by the end of the story.
But he does ask the key question. He asks the key question in this episode. I think he says, "Get me number one," doesn't he? There's that recognition of like, oh, hang on, number two. Okay, that means that there's somebody else. And that is one of the questions that we ask throughout the series. People who haven't watched The Prison before, we may or may not get a satisfactory answer to that question by the end of the series.
Well, I know we'll probably have discussed this in episode zero, but my overriding first memory of The Prisoner of all time is my dad coming in going, oh, Channel 4's showing this. You might want to watch it. You'll love it. You'll hate the last episode. And then he left the room. And that was it. That was my entire... That was my entire introduction to The Prisoner. It was like he warned me. He set it up straight off that you will hate the last episode, but you'll love the series. Because he knew me. He knew I loved The Twilight Zone. He knew I loved, you know, Doctor Who. I loved all TV. He knew me really well. And he knew the sort of thing I would like. You know, I'd gone through my, you know, childhood James Bond phase. And he knew that had gone now. But it was like, yeah, let's do this. Because this is better. And it was like, okay, Dad, you really get TV. That's great. So that's what he did. So, yeah, I do get that. But that was my initial introduction. So, yeah, it's a lovely squashed up version. Also, it does use the same language as the James Bonds. So probably, you know, that whole large, ridiculous, almost Austin Powers, you know, area where things would rise out of the floor and, you know, where it might as well be inside a giant hollowed out volcano, because it just seems like that. But then again, you've got, I was also thinking, sorry, my head is all over the place. And if you listen to the UFO cast, you'll know that this is standard for me. You've got, like I said, when I was studying media years ago, God, it's so long ago now, there was two things that was, I've already mentioned one of them, which was like, this episode is, what was it, Punctum, where it was like the shortened version that illustrates the whole. But then what else was there? It was like what you were saying earlier, Luke, was that it's the work of a group, but it's also the work of one person. It's auteur theory, which you just didn't get on TV for years. But that's what this is. But it's kind of group auteur, and they've all got their own view, which is how come it all keeps going off in a huff and going, no, let's do this with it instead. Because it's 17 different programs, but it's all the same program. And I suppose that's one of the reasons that I loved it so much. And that was my very first experience of the series. So I've always had a very soft spot for it, but that's what stopped me from doing this podcast, because I held it in such high regard, and I know it's held in such high regard by everyone, that I was almost scared of watching it. I was like, I must do too much research. I must know production codes and that kind of thing. You know what it's like. So that I don't show myself up on a podcast just going, oh yeah, I really like the people on a seesaw going up and down, and I like Minnie Mokes. That's good. I didn't want to sound that stupid. But The Prisoner's so deep, got so much going on. We're always going to sound stupid because there's always going to be stuff we've missed.
Yeah. Or as Erica has already pointed out, we are going to look at it in very different ways. And I like the way that you two complement each other with the whole Watsonian Doylist kind of thing. And
oh, gotcha.
I sort of flip-flop around depending on what it is that I'm watching. I can be very Doyleist and very Watsonian with Doctor Who when it suits me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure where I sit with The Prisoner because it is just so bonkers.
Maybe you'll find out as you do this podcast.
Yep.
Maybe, yeah, as I rewatch it for the umpteenth time, I'll be like, oh, okay, this is where I land. So we've had the whole kind of, he's exploring the village, he's met number two, and then you have this whole kind of sussing out his house. There's the maid. Is she trying to blackmail it? Is she trying to get information? What's going on with her? Who can you trust? Who can you not trust? All that kind of stuff. The escape attempt with a helicopter. The bit where he kind of has a fist fight and punches Rover.
At this point in the series,
he doesn't know you can't punch Rover.
Mm-hmm.
And then the whole hospital thing, which is completely and utterly weird, because you get that kind of, I'd forgotten that you get the whole kind of bit with the bald guy going la 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 la, and looking in the various rooms and go, you're like, what have I stumbled into now?
Yeah, he's like, is he making the water fountain? I don't know what it is. Is he making it levitate there? It's why is there that kindly old grandmother knitting in a rocking chair? Is she like, does she go around? Is she like the
keeps an eye on the people who are unconscious?
Yeah, like the comfort nanny or something in the hospital that does, like, that's just, you know, his slippers fit, like everything is just like, yeah, it's very weird. He recognizes someone in the form of Cobb, who then dies apparently shortly after.
The only person with a name in this whole story.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's I find it interesting that they basically are, his escape attempt and the question about who he can trust, they managed to squeeze in basically two stories into the same episode here. Mm-hmm. So in addition to all of the stuff that we've talked about with the discovery, you know, finding the maid in his house and the fact that her number is 666, of course I noticed that right away, and yeah, can he trust her? And of course not. Like, he just decides no, he's not going to, like, and it's just a very, very abbreviated version of something that could have been its own 1 hour story. And you know, number two is like, okay, this he's a tougher nut to crack. This isn't going to work this way. And then I appreciate sort of the flip that the second time we get the woman who is very clearly working with number two, but in actuality was trying to help him and didn't realize that she was just a pawn, as she is, is told later. So, I mean, they kind of do both sides of the same story in this episode. And what, her number is number 9, which is a 6 upside down.
Right.
So, I mean, it's just like all of the things that I can't help
and
notice.
And she also gets lied to by number 2 about Cobb being dead.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, oh, so she's also of the opinion that he's dead as well. Because I was watching it going, well, if she's in on it, surely she would know it. Oh, no, that's not what happened. And then weirdly in the script, they're just referred to as woman and girl. But it's really nice that they've actually got numbers. But yeah, getting back to that hospital bit, not just the guy shouting at an egg or a spoon or doing something with the water or something. There's a bit where they're all in a room and he says it's a group therapy, but they're all sitting in silence in the dark.
With this weird light, face masks on. It's like eye masks. It's just...
It's like, that's not group therapy.
Not as we.
And we also have the all the slogans on the wall, which you've alluded to, Stephen. I think it was this is the prisoner font, which is ubiquitous. I'm going to bring up Babylon 5 at this point because there is a link there with the font and with themes from The Prisoner. And for those that don't know, Erica was one of the co-hosts of the audio guide to Babylon 5. And Stephen, I think you were listening, you were watching along as a newbie.
Yes, I was.
So this is another podcast that you can go and track down. But when did you become aware of the link between the two shows, Erica?
I think I had kind of known that J. Michael Straczynski, the creator of it, was a fan of it, but I didn't actually recognize any of, I saw it well before I saw The Prisoner. So it was sort of like the reverse excitement for me, because as we were going through watching The Prisoner, I was like, Oh, be seeing you. That Bester says that in Babylon 5. So I was coming at it from the exact opposite angle. So I knew that there would be some connections, and it was sort of like I was discovering them in the wrong way or the backwards way anyway.
Yeah, no, that works. Mm-hmm. Before we get into talking about actors, is there anything else anybody wants to kind of say about the episode? Anything that we've not touched upon that you really think that we should? And I'll start again with you, Erica, and then we'll go Stephen and then Michael.
I have to say that I was surprised, pleasantly surprised, when I first watched this at how many women we actually get on the screen and who get to talk, because that is that's a thing that varies. And I mean, my threshold is much, much lower for a show, you know, that's airing in 1967 than it would be, say, for a show that's today. So while, you know, you get a lot of women on screen, they get a lot of lines, the labor is still very much sort of divided along gender lines. You have women as maids, you have a guy who owns a store, you have a woman who is cleaning up for the shop. The taxi drivers are all women, which is interesting, one of whom is Asian, so those, you know, nice representation of women of color who actually get some lines. And
I think they also just wanted to say that, like, you know, hammer home that there are people from all over the world.
Yes.
Here.
Yeah,
you know.
which is great.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. But I like that that we have more women doing things, and this is something that will continue throughout the show, that you actually get ladies in positions of power. And even in this one, you know, somebody who is supposed to be working with the machinery of the quote unquote bad guys to dupe him, except not, is a woman. And it's not always going to be playing on his pity and or romance, which never really works. So it's pretty nice that mm-hmm. that there's at least something for 1967. That ain't bad.
Mm-hmm. Great.
I think this episode perhaps more than any showcases the village, the actual location. Mm-hmm. I mean, not, I think, like, just a very select few episodes were actually shot here, like that first block or something. Then there's a bunch of other stuff where they have, like, they basically reuse some footage, and they do mock-ups in the studio and stuff. But, like, there are far fewer episodes than we realize that are actually shot there. And it's just really nice to see that village and just see mm-hmm. him rocking around it. I like how they work. Like, it's the first episode, but they work in everything so naturally. Because as you said, Erica, like, the prisoner doesn't know anything about this world either, so he has to be explained. And I like the little helicopter tour. We learn about the whole thing.
Yes.
But it's a helicopter tour to inform the prisoner about this new place, his new home and stuff. So we learn as well by proxy. So yeah, I just love looking at the location and how well they used it.
Mm-hmm. Also, mm-hmm. lava lamps.
Lava lamps. Many lava lamps.
I have been a huge fan of lava lamps and have had some in my home since I was in my teens. Like, there's literally one in my dresser right now. So seeing those displayed so nicely, although I think my one quibble, my only quibble with this entire episode, is the fact that as he's discovering his new home, walking around, he looks at a lava lamp, and it is it's the red lava lamp, and then we get a close-up, or no, it's the other way around. I think he looks at a blue lava lamp,
right.
And then we get a close-up on the lava lamp, but it's a close-up of the one that's behind him in his bedroom, not the one he's looking at. Only quibble. That's my one and only quibble.
There are so many fast cuts in this episode.
It's insanely fast, isn't it?
It is. Like, it's just, it's almost, you know, purposely disorientating that I just, yeah, the whole style of it. Mm-hmm. The location, the style of the way they shoot it. I mean, it's just visionary. It's not, this is a TV show from 1967, and it looks and feels like this. And it just, nothing has ever been made like The Prisoner since.
Mm-hmm.
It really shows in that first episode.
Including the remake.
Which they shot in Namibia, I believe, the late Michael Pickwood being the designer on that, and Nick Hurren of Day of the Doctor fame directing it. So it looks and sounds good, but it's not at all.
It's its own
like
thing.
This. It is very much its own thing.
It's its own thing. Michael, anything further to say about the plot of the episode?
Well, plot-wise, well, I don't know. I mean, there was loads of things I had in my little notebook to mention, but we've kind of covered most of them. Things like, as we mentioned in passing, that is there cloning going on in there? There's lots of little bits that make you go, oh, is this happening or is this happening? So they're just part of the ongoing mysteries. And you know what? That's kind of not what this chat's really gone into. But there's lots of stuff about, like, the music that you mentioned earlier on, like the Pop Goes the Weasel. And there's what you're kind of watching it going, I know what's happening as you let it wash over you. But the minute you start thinking about it, you're going, what, eh? And it's like, because we're, by the, if you're watching the episode along at this point, you're with, you've reached sort of the Cobb's funeral. And then, like you said, number nine and his plan to escape with all sorts of stuff. And the relationships with the female characters is the thing that sets this apart from almost everything else on TV. On a purely, oh, I've sat down to watch a spy drama kind of thing. It's proof that he really should never have played James Bond because his relationship with women is so not James Bondy. And it's just so refreshing to see that. But that's just because I'm watching it on a certain level. The other levels where you're going, well, what is going on? There's so many questions. And as the series becomes more weird progressively, it's just such a lovely journey that you stop asking these questions. You're just kind of going, just let it happen. It's great. So, yeah, there's lots of stuff in my notebook, but I'm looking at it going, I don't want to see any of those things. I just want to say, isn't it great? Because, like you said, the way it's shot is great. The transfer to Blu-ray, fantastic. I was talking earlier about the ITV documentary about Port Merion. There was a guy who paints the place now who actually watches the Blu-ray to color match the buildings now with them they were in 1967.
I love that.
And when he's saying that, I'm like, you can stay, mate. I like you. Yeah. So it's so of its time, but it's so itself. And we can't, that's the reason I was so scared to do the podcast, because it's such an important piece of TV, because nobody else ever got to make TV like this again. Perhaps Babylon 5 was the closest American TV ever got to this. It was one guy's vision being given to us. And yeah, it's got parallels with Lord of the Rings and all that kind of stuff, but it is its own creature. And that's what this is. This is mainly one person's view, but lots of other people in on it, providing us with something different. And yeah, they're constantly banging on about, oh, it's information that they want. They want to know all about him, but they also know what food he likes, what his preferences are. And I know this will make no sense when this finally comes out, but this is the month where Facebook changed its name to Meta. And that's what Facebook is. Facebook is the village, because all they want is information. They want to know everything about you, and you're trapped in its little world. So it's of its time from 1960-odd, but it's so pertinent for now. And it always has been. It was in the 80s. It was every time it's been shown on the TV, it said something about the time that it's being broadcast. And you can't get TV better than that. You just can't. I don't know. I brought everything to a standstill. But
no, it's a lovely summing up. It's a lovely summing up. So moving sort of towards rounding up, one of the things that we did on the UFO cast was we wanted to kind of geek out about the actors who kept cropping up in UFO, who had A, been in The Prisoner, and B, been in Doctor Who, because we're both big Doctor Who fans, we're both big Prisoner fans. We're not going to do the UFO ones this time round. If you want to find out those, go and listen to the UFO cast and get to that point in the episode where we go, and who's in the Prisoner? But we're always going to, and particularly Erica and Stephen, you're also massive Doctor Who fans as well. This is always a game that we play with watching classic British TV. Well, and obviously lots of modern TV as well, given that Doctor Who has been around for so long now on modern TV. There's all these people that you're like, oh, that person was in Doctor Who. So, who did you spot? I have got five just by looking at IMDb. I might have missed somebody. So, we'll throw it open to Michael first, because Michael is famously useless at this game.
Can I explain to anyone who's like new, right? Because, you know, yes, I am useless. I will put my hand up and say this, but there's a reason. In real life, if I meet someone who's had a haircut, I don't recognise them. right? It's just, if someone is not where they're supposed to be, like if I know someone from work, but I see them in a shop, my brain just goes into meltdown going, who the hell's that? I know them from somewhere. And it's like, you've worked with them for years, you idiot. So when I see someone in Doctor Who, it's, they have to have a very obscure voice or something odd about them or an incredible performance for me to go, oh yeah, I've seen them in something else. Now, I'm a lot better at this with voices and voiceover work since listening to so much Big Finish. So with this one, I'm just going to go with your standard Christopher Benjamin straight off the bat because, you know, of the exciting world of Jago and Lightfoot. And then I'll possibly mention Muscarat, but that's as far as I'm going. I'm going with the two.
Yes, so two points to... I mean, this is, we're not scoring this. But yes, Christopher Benjamin, from Talons of Weng Chiang and Inferno.
And indeed, The Unicorn and the Wasp.
And indeed, The Unicorn and the Wasp. Yes, sorry, yeah, modern Doctor Who as well. And I was fortunate enough to interview him on behalf of the Doctor Who podcast years ago. And there was a little bit of prisoner chat, which I think they cut. So I'm going to have to go back through the archive and see if I can find that interview and dig up the little bit of prisoner chat that we had.
We've been playing that scene, the episode out, and literally his scene just appeared. It reminded me of just the allegory of him, like, you know, asking the questions, the bureaucratic questions as he's spinning the little Tonka toy, Tinker toy rather, version of, you know, the operation, and then, you know, number six smashes it. And I just love that. As we cut back to number two, going, oh, it's going to be a tough nut to crack and all that. And Christopher Benjamin's character is just frantically trying to put it back together again.
Yeah.
Like he's trying to repair the system that number six broke. I just thought it was a wonderful visual. Anyway.
No, it's brilliant. Yeah. I love his performance. And he will be back. Spoilers, yes. Slightly. And Angelo Muscat, you're right, Michael, and this is well timed for us recording this, because as we record, Galaxy 4, the animated version of Galaxy 4 is due out on Monday, I believe.
For you.
For us. I mean, I haven't got it on pre-order, unfortunately. I might end up getting it for Christmas. But and he played one of the Chumblies, because he is very short of stature. One of the things I love about him is on the back of the Blu-ray, it says starring Patrick McGoohan and Angelo Muscat, because they are the two people that appear in every single episode of the show. And he's the silent, enigmatic butler who we didn't touch upon. He doesn't do much in this episode, but he's just there.
But he does a lot. You know,
he does a lot and just brilliantly played.
With that ever-present black and white umbrella. You know, I love that just as number six is going to the helicopter to take what he thinks is his way out of there, in the background, the butler walks by holding the umbrella as if to say that you're never leaving. You're under this umbrella forever. There's those little visual motifs that crop up throughout the series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Erica, can you add to our list of Doctor Who actors?
No, I have never even tried to play this game. Stephen and I are working our way for the first time through Midsummer Murders, which has
no spoilers.
Do not tell us who appears. We consider actors spoilers, so we don't want to know.
I've never seen it.
Well, good. Okay.
Well, it's got.
I think the answer is everybody.
Yeah.
Eventually, yes, but
basically,
but in what order?
Yeah. So we are, I don't know, a dozen seasons in at this point, and we schedule at least 20 minutes after watching every episode to scroll through IMDb and check and see. But really, it's Stephen pointing at the screen in the middle of the episode going, oh, look, it's so-and-so, or oh, look, it's so-and-so. Every once in a while, I will recognize somebody, but it is super rare, and it has to be somebody like Peter Davison. I can recognize Peter Davison.
He was in Doctor Who.
Yes, right. he was in Doctor Who, don't you know? So it has to be somebody sort of that stature, because otherwise I don't have an excuse like face blindness. I
haven't got an excuse like that. I'm just crap at it. There's nothing medical wrong. I'm just not very good.
So Stephen is the one.
I mean,
that's
I was
going
watching this,
here.
Going, "Oh, isn't that?" Mm, yeah, yeah, yeah. Go on, Stephen. Show us all.
So I've got three more, Stephen.
I know. I'm impressed. I've got two, and only one that I discovered by on this very viewing, and okay. only after having read the credits. The obvious one is George Baker, who of course was decider Logan.
Oh, the three who rule. Of course, you're going to get that one.
It's also funny. I have been unrelatedly. I've been watching all the James Bond movies, and so not only have I seen a lot of Doctor Who actors and some prisoner actors, but also some prisoner sound effects, because I think they were both pulling from the same stock. Sound effect database, but George Baker not only appeared in the most recent one I watched, which is The Spy Who Loved Me, but also appeared and in many portions of the film overdubbed the voice of George Lazenby in On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Wow.
So he's had quite a notable career, and he pops up as the new number two in this one.
Mm-hmm.
The second one that I also noticed Patsy Smart. I didn't recognize the name, and I just watched Blake 7 recently, and then when I saw IMDb that she was in an episode called Duel, the only one directed by Douglas Campfield, and she was in that. I thought she might have been in Doctor Who.
Oh, that's good, that one. Wrong. That one's very good.
No, she has been in Doctor Who. She is the ghoul at the beginning of Talons of Weng Chiang, who goes...
No! Oh, he's making all sick, that would.
Yeah.
Oh, that's why I recognize the name.
Yeah,
that's why
that's
I recognize,
why you recognize the name.
The name.
Yeah.
That's why I totally skimmed past her. Oh,
see, you need to check every person.
Making all sick, that would.
Yeah, making all sick.
She took out her false teeth for that. The one that I missed every time up until now, possibly because he didn't have his real hair, which is no hair, and I'm pretty sure his voice was overdubbed, which is a very common practice in this day and age. Was David Garfield as the hospital attendant who says, "I had a free ride home." He, of course, was Neva in The Face of Evil and also General, what's his name, in the War Games.
I thought he looked kind of familiar. Yeah. See, I feel good about myself now just because I had the, he looks familiar. So, like, that's as close as I get.
It's possibly because I have just, in the last couple of weeks, finished a massive Troughton rewatch, and obviously landing up on the War Games with Von Weich. That I was maybe primed to recognise him this time, but I've literally never seen him in this episode before because it is a blink and you'll miss it. Yeah, and I was like, oh, it's David Goffin.
Well, you know, every time I've watched it, I thought his hair looks really silly, and now I know why, because it's probably a very bad toupee from 1967 because he's very bald, even in the War Games.
I think we've got them all. And I don't think there's anybody obviously behind the scenes in terms of writing and directing on this episode.
No. I will add that I've in my desire to watch archive British TV and try to spot Doctor Who actors, I did watch the first episode of Yes Minister, and which of course I noticed Paul Eddington, who was probably very famous for that, but had a very small role in this. As Cobb.
So he was the other person that I wanted to ask you both about as to because for British viewers he is very famous for two sitcom roles. You've just mentioned one of them, Stephen, as James Hacker, Minister for Administrative Affairs in Yes Minister, and then subsequently Prime Minister in Yes Prime Minister. And before that, in the 70s, with the chief caretaker himself from Paradise Towers, Richard Briers, in The Good Life. So the question to both of you is how familiar were you with either of those before you saw The Prisoner? And so did Paul Eddington's appearance mean anything to you when you first saw Arrival?
Not when I first saw it.
It still doesn't.
Only this time around. And like, I saw the first episode of Yes Minister like maybe 2 months ago. So like, it was relatively fresh in the brain. At the time, I recognized him, but I didn't know where from. He might just be one of those British faces, I thought. This is a common debate with Erica and me. Whether was he in Doctor Who or is he just British? And that's the
argument.
So second one. You are in for a delightful ride with Yes Minister, both in terms of actors from Doctor Who and one in particular from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I don't want to spoil his appearance because there's a great Doctor Who cameo. It's a line about UNESCO.
Okay.
I'm not going to say anything more about that, but you will be delighted by who it is and the line when you get to it in Yes, Prime Minister, I think.
Okay.
But it's a veritable feast of Doctor Who actors is Yes Minister. And yes, Prime Minister. So I guess to ask you, Michael, for you, what was it like having Paul Eddington turn up in the prison?
Well, it was just odd. You were kind of, oh, that's Jerry, isn't it? And Jerry and Margot. Hang on. Felicity Kendall also did Doctor Who as well. So there was only, didn't she?
Yes.
Didn't she do one of the new ones?
She's in the Unicorn and the Wasp.
She's in the Unicorn and the Wasp. There you go.
With Christopher Benjamin, yes.
There's only one of the four main cast that has never done Doctor Who, and she still could.
There's always a chance.
But hang on, but Paul Eddington and Penelope Keith have not done Doctor Who.
Oh, no.
Because we're in the prison now, aren't we?
Yeah, because we're in the prison now. Yes. Okay, yeah. Oh, yeah, I haven't even got the excuse of what hour we're recording either.
Yeah.
So, can I just say it's been an absolute pleasure having monuments of podcasting with us.
Yeah, no, it was lovely when we asked you and you said yes. It was great.
It's been delightful.
No, thank you for coming on. So, because for you it's sometime in the afternoon and for us it's getting late. So Michael already has the perfect sign-off because he has been signing off in this way since he started podcasting. So I guess it just remains to say, be seeing you.
Ahi se tona.
Be seeing you.
Be seeing you.